Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
All right, now that the issue of giving money to U.S. allies is over with, Congress can return to the task of dishing out cash to federal agencies, as lawmakers are finally able to start work on appropriations for the 2025 fiscal year. However, there are still some rumblings from within the Republican Party that Speaker Mike Johnson may have to worry about down the line. To get an update from Capitol Hill, we welcome Maeve Sheehy, congressional reporter with Bloomberg Government. Maeve, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So those appropriations are finally going to start happening after all the squabbling has finished up and they can finally get back to business. Is that the case?
Well, they'll definitely be able to start working on them. It's kind of interesting that we're talking about 2025 appropriations bills starting right now because it's midway through 2024 and we just finished the 2024 funding bills. So it's an interesting place for Congress to be in. And you'll remember that last time Congress tried to get all 12 appropriations bills done, didn't go great. They ended up in too many buses. And there were a lot of fights within the GOP about things like a mifepristone rider, for example, and other kind of social issues that got tacked on. So there's really no reason to believe that won't also happen for 2025 appropriations bills. And given that they run out at the end of September, we're probably looking at another continuing resolution at some point.
Yeah, and with these, you know, some lawmakers being up for election and they want to really highlight those social issues, are there any sort of ones that, you know, may be right out in front? Are we going to see another holdup of defense promotions, things of that nature?
There could be, for sure. I mean, now that the Ukraine funding has passed, that kind of foreign aid caused a lot of issues within the conference, but now that issue has gone away. So Republicans will need to work on other issues that they want to kind of campaign on. There are some so-called culture wars that could be tacked on, like with LGBTQ rights, with abortion, that's a big one. But what you'll see, which is really interesting, is that even while more conservative House lawmakers are trying to get these front and center in appropriations bills, the more moderate Republicans don't really want that to be part of this because there are a lot of them are in competitive districts. So if they want to win to Democrats and win over some independent voters, they probably don't want abortion to be front and center.
Yeah. And those moderate Republicans may have to look to the other side of the aisle again for some help. Is that going to be the case in making sure that business continues as usual for government agencies?
It certainly could be. To get some sort of continuing resolution done, that probably can't be done with just Republican votes because you do have this kind of right flank of the Republican Party in the House that is just very conservative and very against continuing resolutions, or CRs as they're called around here. They don't want any stopgap funding. And so we could be headed for a government shutdown if there can't be some sort of bipartisan compromise to keep the government open.
Don't say government shutdown. I don't need those hours that much. And I'm sure you don't either.
No, I mean, we got kind of close to them a few times in the past year. So in September, we might be looking at that again.
We're speaking with Maeve Sheehy. She is the House reporter for Bloomberg Government. And another program that Congress is going to have to deal with, the Affordable Connectivity Program. You may or may not have heard of it, and it kind of spans all parts of the country as it is internet subsidies for low-income households, whether in the city or especially out in rural areas. What can you tell me about what is happening there?
Yeah, so the FCC had requested about $6 billion for Congress to appropriate so that they could keep this program running. It helps a lot of people. It reaches about 23 million households across the country. And in some states, like in Louisiana, 1 in 3 households are directly benefited from it. Basically gives them a discount on their internet. And it's really popular among providers. If you look at lobbying reports, you'll see that Verizon, Comcast, AT&T, they all spent money to lobby on this issue in the past quarter because it benefits them when people can get high-speed internet, basically. But the funds will run out this week at the end of the month. So at the end of April is what the FCC has said. And so unless Congress can act really quickly, which, as we've seen, does not necessarily happen in this Congress, there will be a lapse. So a lot of households will be looking at higher internet bills. Some people might not be able to pay their internet bills. And obviously in this kind of modern era where so many things are virtual, that's going to be a really big problem for people.
Is it more of just a procedural hurdle that this program is facing, or are there some principled stances being taken on as far as, you know, the actual basis of the program?
So if you look at a bill that would extend the program, the majority of Congress is signed on. So a lot of Republicans are in favor of this, especially Republicans in competitive districts who, you know, maybe some of their voters actually benefit from this. But then on the right, the far right of the GOP, you see some people saying that they want the program to sunset because they see it as kind of corporate welfare. They see it benefiting like Verizon and AT&T and Comcast. And their argument is that if the program is allowed to end, then these companies won't be getting kind of kickbacks and they'll end up passing along lower costs for internet to the consumer. There's a big divide within the House GOP about that, which is pretty interesting to watch. And Mike Johnson will need to navigate that, because if he does decide to put a bill on the floor that would extend the program, he's going to have some people from the right of his party who are not too happy with him.
Other than, you know, the FCC reporting on what's going to happen, has the agency said anything about the potential impact if this does not come to fruition?
The agency has been trying really hard to get Congress to extend this. It's something that they've said is really important to closing the digital divide. I mean, we saw after COVID that a lot of people do not have high-speed internet or don't have internet access at all. And so the FCC has kind of billed this as a really important part of the Biden administration's efforts to get people online so that they can go to work or go to school or go to telehealth appointments or something like that.
Gotcha. All right. And you had talked about it a little bit there in your previous answer as far as Speaker Mike Johnson having to navigate these tricky waters within his own party. You know, he got past the argument whether or not Israel and Ukraine should receive the funding from the U.S. government, but he may have not come out of that unscathed. What could he be seeing down the line as far as more agitation from within his own party?
Yeah, so there are three members currently who are advocating for an ouster. They want to force a motion to vacate, which you'll remember is what Matt Gaetz did to Kevin McCarthy. He's no longer speaker, so we've seen how that goes. But there are three members of the party who are publicly calling for Mike Johnson to be ousted. And if they put that on the floor for a vote, then it will come down to whether Democrats join them or not. Democrats joined to oust McCarthy, but they also had like years of trust issues. Whereas with Johnson, he's more of a blank slate. And some Democrats have said that they'd be willing to save him, you know, if they can move forward as sort of a bipartisan governing coalition, as Minority Leader Jeffries likes to say. So if Johnson is bailed out by Democrats, that also puts him in an interesting situation, because there are a lot more members in his party who would see that as kind of a betrayal. They don't want to work across the aisle.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about how it happened last time for Kevin McCarthy. Could we start to maybe see any rule changes from the next Congress as far as selecting a speaker or having these votes come forward? You know, could we see that you may be required to have more support before even bringing this to the House floor, just because of how this is kind of holding things up now, of Congress actually getting anything done?
Absolutely. So last Congress, when Pelosi was speaker, there was a higher threshold for the amount of members who needed to bring this motion to vacate to the floor. And then when Kevin McCarthy was trying to win the speaker vote way back last year, he needed to make some tough deals with hardline conservatives in his party so that they would vote for him. And one of those deals was that just one member could bring the motion to vacate to the floor. And as we've seen over the past year, that has caused huge turmoil in the House. So we have basically a small group of members that could unseat a speaker, theoretically, because there's such a tight margin in the House. The next Congress, I definitely think that we'll have at least a very concentrated group of people trying to push for a higher threshold. So it's just one member could not necessarily derail a party like this. And there was actually some talk a couple weeks ago where more mainstream members of the Republican Party were saying, hey, maybe we can change this now. And there were maybe like 3 hours where Johnson seemed to be considering it. And then he very publicly tweeted out they wouldn't be changing those rules because he said they don't have a majority of the House that would approve that rules change.
Yeah, and it's almost like he'd be getting rid of the rule that is the reason why he's in that position anyway, right?
Yeah, it would be tough politically for him for sure. And it also might not be workable to actually get across the floor.
All right. Well, we'll have to wait and see on that one. Maeve Sheehy is a House reporter for Bloomberg Government. Thank you so much for giving us an update on what's going on Capitol Hill.
Thanks for having me.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective, we get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down, so I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're gonna go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture. Because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well.
Thank you.
Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And work alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.